95% is left. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. The signal has to bounce back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. Ain't that crazy? There is no book that says that. All the experiments I've done, all the patents I've been involved in, all the antennas I've been involved in the design of, used that information, and I consider it extremely valuable basic information. Now you know why resonance is so important, because the signal's going to bounce back and forth 20 times. You want all of those bounces to be co-phase. You want them to be in step with each other. That's the definition of resonance. If the wire is too long, the signal comes back a little bit too late. We call that, and therefore you've got a lagging phase angle. We call that inductive reactance. But the wire is a little bit too short, the signal comes back too soon. Leading phase angle. We call that capacitor reactance. And so if you make the dipole a little bit too long or a little bit too short, the reactance builds up real fast, even though the resistive component doesn't change very much, and therefore it becomes very hard to feed, and you end up with a very high standing wave ratio. Now you know why you must resonate. Therefore, for all...
Repeater, time out.
I'm getting good at timing it out tonight. Therefore, of all of these years, of anybody who has ever been listening to the TechNet, you frequently hear me say the most important thing about a dipole, the most important thing about any antenna, you resonate first, then you can radiate. There is no book that says that extremely basic, extremely important information. Resonate first, then you can radiate. Without a doubt, there are some non-resonant antennas out there. As when it comes to radiation efficiency, they are really terrible by comparison to a resonant structure. Yeah, you can make an antenna way out of resonance if you want to, but it will be, the signal coming out of it is going to be 20 decibels weaker, and the standing wave ratio is going to be huge. Resonate first, then you can radiate. Of the 30-some-odd books that I own on the subject of antennas, not one of them says that. In very coded language, let me drop. In very coded language, they will call some of these basic antennas a standing wave structure. And what's really crazy is a signal bouncing back 20 times means that the standing wave ratio inside of the antenna is huge, even though the feed line going into it has a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Of course, that seems very opposite of common sense. But if you look at that Walter Lewin YouTube video, he's that extremely famous, very intelligent, head of the science department at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You listen to his demonstration and explanation and diagrams on the board. You listen to his theory and you look at his demonstration of what's called a non-conservative magnetic field. That signal bouncing back 20 times means that the antenna's got a Q of 20. One of the definitions of Q is that the current is rising 20 times higher because of resonance. A Q of 20 means that the current is 20 times higher than you launched into it. The Q of 20 means the voltage is 20 times higher. So at the tips of the dipole, the voltage is 20 times higher than your feed line. Near the center of the dipole, the current is 20 times higher than your feed line. And because the magnetic field created by 20 times higher current gives you a much better ability to radiate. It's that magnetic field that's a very important component of the radiation. Now, whether or not the energy, let me drop. Whether or not the energy bouncing back on a dipole can be called displacement energy, whether or not you want to call it resonant energy, that's a part of the standing wave structure, whether it's increasing the internal Q of the dipole, energy stored versus energy dissipated per cycle, that's another definition of Q. If the Q is 20, then on each cycle, 5% of the energy is dissipated, 95% is left over. That's the ratio of energy loss per cycle versus energy stored per cycle. Another definition of Q. There's 5 or 6 definitions of Q. They are all the exact same phenomena, with just different ways of looking at it, different ways of making the measurement. There are a few, let me drop. You dig deep enough, you'll find a few scientists have had an operating dipole, put an extremely small current sensing loop at the end of a coax cable, a sensing coax cable near the dipole, and confirm the fact that the current is 20 times higher, or that the voltage is 20 times higher at the tips. various ways in a non-disturbing manner. You can make these measurements on a dipole. The problem is that the person who did those measurements didn't go the next step to show the ratio between those currents on the transmission line versus the dipole, and the ratio of the voltages on the dipole versus the transmission line. You'd be amazed how many people are sort of dumbfounded when they hear this the first time. Now, so I'm not quite sure now how displacement current, by the way, when an AC current is flowing through a capacitor, you could watch in theory some of those electrons entering one side of the capacitor, and you will see electrons coming out of the other side of the capacitor. And at that particular frequency, where the capacitor has a relatively small capacitor reactance, the signal flows through. Let me drop. So common sense would lead you to believe, while the current is flowing in one side and out of the other side, you assume it's the exact same electrons. Absolutely not. If you painted all the electrons going into that capacitor blue compared to the ones that were already there, and then you look at the electrons coming out of the other side of the capacitor, none of the blue electrons would be there. It's a crazy component. So maybe this does or doesn't relate to what you're talking about, with displacement current on a dipole, Wes. N2XJN, KQLIW in the TechNet.
IS query.
Actually, yeah. Okay. The question to what you're saying. Well, at first for me, the displacement current that comes from Maxwell equation is the particular basis or foundation for the electromagnetic waves, and derivation is accepted as a historical landmark in physics. For uniting electricity and magnetism, optics, and single field cure. Let me go further with that. Well, first, when we're dealing with the Maxwell equations and we're trying to understand displacement current, there are a few things that are happening. I spoke before the TechNet with John when we discussed a loop of wire that is cut in one point and have two plates. So based on the Maxwell equations, when you have a charge, on one plate, then the current flows through the wire all around, and according to the right-hand rule, will end up on other charge on the other plate. But then we have a space in between them, and that's where the displacement current is. And the displacement current has a different vector in opposite direction. So at that point, if we talk about the dipole antenna, we're talking about if we come only from the Maxwell equations, we will have a dipole antenna not radiating because The vectors will actually cancel themselves. Let me go for that. So when you go to one of the most fundamental Maxwell equations would be D epsilon OE plus P, where D will stand for the displacement. Epsilon zero will be permittivity of the free space, so that would be displacement equal to the permittivity of the free space times the electrical field intensity E plus P, and P is polarization of the medium. So that when we go with that, then we are actually coming to the derivation that actually leads us to many things, and one of them would be the Gauss law, then the other one would be the Schrodinger equation, and so whatsoever. What I'm trying to say, what this ham radio scientist did is he actually showed in one single paper and also in his video that a Newton gravity equation is probably translated discrete, Langerian Hamiltonian is also discrete, Coulomb equation is discrete, and Maxwell equation out of this quiz. And he has a pretty much strong up, expected with a few scientists from Germany, and they had a puzzle with it. In other words, the problem is that what he said is that we go that equation, the alarm bells goes off as soon as we see the permittivity of free space, and I could say the permittivity of the free space is misaligned to free space in those equations, and since free space cannot have any physical characteristic of the field, then there would be nor charge nor space existing in it. But anyhow, my question to you is, you have a light bulb, fluorescent light bulb in presence of the high electric field. Hold it in your hands. Question is, that light bulb that is fluorescent and is lighting, would that draw the current from the source? The second question is how the loop is being closed. Fundamental questions about the antenna are actually very closely related to it, and that's why I feel that this question is appropriate for the first hour. Enter Jim.
Yeah. A judge in this case, Wes, would say that we're getting dangerously close to being a scientist as opposed to hams. A ham radio operator is a kind of an engineer, in my opinion, who wants useful engineering information. That means something he can take and run with and go immediately to the backyard and properly tune that antenna and know what he should be looking for. That, to me, is useful engineering information. And we're starting to stray from that, from my point of view. But in the case of an incandescent light bulb, you and I know that the current is flowing through a wire. The wire has got resistance. The wire gets hot. Anything that's above absolute zero temperature is radiating at some particular wavelength. Hot things do that. In the case of a fluorescent tube, there is a real plasma, usually a mercury vapor plasma, inside of that tube. And many a ham radio operator, let me drop it.
The light bulb is not connected anywhere. You're holding it in hands and it's lighting. Is drawing current or is not from the source?
Many a ham radio operator has held a fluorescent tube, sometimes a small one, sometimes a full-size one, near his antenna, near the tank circuit of a tube-type transmitter, anywhere there is extremely high voltage. The tips of a dipole have got extremely high voltage. The resonating circuit of a tube-type transmitter has got high voltage. You hold a fluorescent light bulb near it. A strong cyclic RF currents and voltages around that resonator of the plate circuit of the transmitter or near the tip of the dipole will excite the mercury vapor inside of the fluorescent tube. The mercury vapor, in turn, does its emitting. It happens to be an ultraviolet emission. The ultraviolet emission of a mercury vapor hits the phosphor of the tube, and you see light. So many of us have held a fluorescent tube connected to nothing, or maybe your hand is on the contact and one end, and you get a little bit brighter light when you do that. Your hand is acting like a ground. The near capacitance coupling of the other end of the fluorescent tube near the high voltage circuit will excite into the fluorescent tube. The fluorescent tube, until the mercury vapor starts conducting, becomes a plasma, the tube itself is nearly an open circuit. So if you put it near the plate tank circuit of a transmitter, let me drop it, and your transmitter may have 850 volts on the plate circuit, and therefore when that pi network near the tube, near the anode of the tube, is doing its transmitting, resonating, is around 800 volts peak positive, 800 volts peak negative, around 1600 volts peak to peak RF at 3.5 megacycles, we'll say. That's where I did this experiment. So 850 volts applied to an 807 tube in my particular case. There's probably 1600 volts peak to peak coming out of the plate circuit. Hold the fluorescent tube near it, a neon tube near it. Hold anything that has an ionizing potential gas internal. That gas will become excited by the local E-field. and the tube will be brighter if your finger is on one of the contacts, and maybe both of the contacts, and the rest of the neon bulb or the fluorescent tube is held near. It doesn't even have to touch. The capacitive coupling is exciting a very large voltage in the vicinity of the ionizable gas. The gas does become ionized. It does emit. So there's lots of ways of explaining it, but many of us have done that. A neon tube is a very nice local RF indicator. We're going to pick you up in a second, Bill. AC2IS wanted to sign in with a question on my previous comment. Back to you for one more comment on this one, Wes, and then we got to move on. N2X shared
quick comment, Dick.
Okay. Wes first, and then John in that order. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
I have to give you what he's asking, Dick.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, John.
He's asking simply, if the fluorescent tube illuminates, is it drawing current from the source? That was his question.
That's almost an academic question. Obvious by the fact the source is exciting energy into the tube, obvious by the fact that the tube is giving out light, and you can't get energy into that fluorescent tube, you can't get energy into that neon bulb, even though it's not making any direct contact. Whenever you're operating in an RF circuit, there is always stray capacitance between your circuit and the thing that you're holding. That stray capacitance, even though there is no direct contact, is exciting current into the device, is exciting voltage into the device, is exciting energy into the device. Energy is there, obvious by the fact that light is being given off. Is the current drawn? Absolutely. You could, with proper instrumentation, take the leads of the neon bulb, the leads of the fluorescent tube on one side, even though the other side is connected to nothing. You can put the right kind of instrumentation there. You will measure a current draw. Your next question is going to be, what happens if I don't touch the either end of the fluorescent tube? My hand is nearly in the middle of the tube, and I bring it near the transmitter, and the fluorescent tube still lights up. Is current being drawn? Absolutely. Where's the current flowing from to? The capacitive coupling from the transmitter to one end of the fluorescent tube, that capacitive coupling is putting a small amount of current, a large amount of voltage into one end. The other end of the fluorescent tube, connected to nothing, has a certain amount of capacitance to space. And current is flowing out of that end into space. And by the right way of installing instrumentation there, very sensitive instrumentation, you could sense that. Of course, it seems to be violating... Let me drop. It seems to be violating common sense that current can be flowing when no electrical contact that your eye can see is occurring on each end of that fluorescent tube. It looks like it's an object floating in space. All you need is a very strong field around that tank circuit. Mostly the inductor is creating a very strong magnetic field. At the end of the inductor, closest to the anode of the tube, an 807 has got a plate cap, by the way, you've got a great big E-field voltage in that area. So there's all kinds of ways of coupling energy into that fluorescent tube that are not obvious. You hold that fluorescent tube a couple of feet in front of a dipole as radiating a significant amount of energy, I'd say for instance 432, connected to nothing, it will light. Is current flowing through it? Absolutely. Even though there's no apparent contact from what your eye can see. It's a crazy circuit. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
It's a bit puzzled because at first you're talking about being a victim of the poor education, then something is too complicated. The problem is about the antenna, and that's why he talked about the fluorescent light. The constant, which is the permittivity of two fixed plates, is 8.85 times 8 to minus 12 divided by 8 squared, which actually says about the spatial component of the free space, and that is why if you take 1 milliwatt of power from the transmitter and you transmit the signal, and then the signal goes X distance on the space, actually it would be 295 times 8 to minus 12 meter per square, but doesn't matter. We have a 1 meter out of power, we transmit omnidirectionally, and then we could calculate the number of antennas that would be able to receive that signal in the far field. Because what you said about the fluorescent bulb, at least what I understood you said, applies to the antennas. That's where the nonsense comes from, and to XGM.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there, Wes. You said you could calculate the number of antennas that could receive that signal. I say you cannot calculate the number of antennas. Because what's your definition of a signal? In the case of Voyager, out there at 8 billion miles, three times the distance to Pluto is where it is, radiating some fraction of 20 watts of power. What's the maximum distance at which we could receive that? There is no maximum.
You don't understand one thing. One thing you don't understand. If you say we cannot calculate, actually you're proving the natural window for the over unit. That means that the magnetic field is twice bigger. That's what you're actually trying. Either the fluorescent light that is kept in hand and not connected is drawing power or is not drawing power. It's nothing more or nothing different from the dipole antenna. So if you then say we cannot calculate, then you cannot state that fluorescent light is drawing the current. And to FGM.
Disagree with that. Okay. If I'm sending signals to an antenna, what is the minimum signal I could send to an antenna over the U.S.?
You got to repeat the question, didn't get it.
You told me you can calculate, and I say you cannot calculate, the number of antennas you could be exciting with your transmitter. The number of antennas you're exciting, the threshold is when did the receiving antenna get the signal? The first question has to be answered. What is the minimum signal that you can send to an antenna, and you'll say a signal is there? I say there is no minimum. As Voyager goes out further and further, and by the inverse square law, the signal is getting weaker and weaker, but we will still get that signal forever. You give me a big enough radio telescope with a big enough antenna to gather that signal. You give me a narrow enough bandwidth of the data being transmitted. That signal will always be above threshold. There is no limit. How weak can a signal be to an antenna? It's way beyond saying how many grains of sand are there on planet Earth. It's way beyond that. There is no minimum. You give me the right kind of instrumentation, no matter how weak that signal is on the antenna, I will tell you the signal is above threshold. I don't care if the signal is a milliwatt of signal from 8 billion miles away. There will always be a signal on that antenna. There is no minimum.
Therefore, there is no minimum light bulb, fluorescent light bulb, that could be in the vicinity of the source and to exist.
Comment?
I didn't say that. You need a minimum threshold to excite, to create the plasma inside of a neon bulb or inside of a... You need a minimum in that case. A radio signal going into an antenna does not need a minimum if you have no restriction on the equipment you're using. You give me the right equipment connected to that antenna, I will always hear that signal, no matter how weak it is. KC2WGB, K2LIW, there, John.
Okay, Dick, as you have mentioned about the sphere and the isotropic antenna, if we made the sphere whatever size, if we could cover the interior of that sphere with a total antenna structure that would receive the signal, there's no overunity. We're only going to be able to collect whatever power is being emitted from the antenna located in the center. There's no overunity. I don't care what diameter you make the sphere.
That's right. I agree with it. So then by this token, we cannot calculate the number of antennas or the receiver receiving the signal on 1 milliwatt or whatever the signal it is, then there is unlimited amount of fluorescent light that will be able to light up because one of the first receivers was the receiver that didn't have any power off and was powered out of the signal. So then maybe we could rephrase the question, how many of the germanium detectors, receivers you can connect that would be able to receive 1 milliwatt of the signal and to exist.
we're almost comparing a neon tube, a fluorescent tube, and an antenna receiving a radio signal, and they're not a good comparison. In the case of a fluorescent tube, you have to have a minimum amount of voltage, current, energy going into the fluorescent tube to excite the mercury vapor inside to make it into a plasma where it starts giving off ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light hits the phosphor. The phosphor gives off a visible light that we see. There is a definite threshold amount of energy.
And also with the germanium detectors, what's wrong?
There is a definite threshold amount of energy required to go above the threshold for a fluorescent tube. And the fact that a fluorescent tube lights is absolutely no indication of excess energy, above unit energy, coming from anywhere. A real radio signal doesn't have that threshold. You'll give me a low enough noise figure receiver connected to that antenna, the right kind of a receiver with the right kind of bandwidth, I will always receive that signal no matter how weak it is. You make the signal going through a fluorescent tube weak enough, you don't create the plasma, you don't hit the threshold of the fluorescent tube, and it doesn't light. A fluorescent tube has a definite threshold. A real antenna has no threshold.
See, you don't understand the point. See, in a simple language, very simple language, you have a detector receiver with no battery, like the old times.
Please.
You have a detector, a radio. It doesn't have any battery. It receives the signal from the transmitter. Percentage-wise, it doesn't matter if we have enough to excite the plasma. Percentage-wise, you said we cannot have the number of antennas receiving the signal and those receiving devices don't have any power supply. I ask you, does the fluorescent bulb that is held in the hand is drawing power from the source or is not? So the question now will be quiz. Does the germanium receiver is drawing power from the source or is not? Is it a limited factor or not? And if it's not, then the fluorescent bulb is not limited. We're not talking about over-unity.
I'm glad we're not talking about over-unity and violating conservation of energy, because that's a very controversial one. That's a very hard one, argument to support. In the case of a simple diode detector receiver, germanium diode, cat whisker on gallium, modern-day Schottky diode, modern-day inverse diodes, right? You can find diodes that are more and more sensitive. Therefore, in theory, and I can buy a set of earphones that are not 1,000 ohms, I can buy 3,000 ohms, I can buy 10,000 ohm earphones that are connected to that simple diode receiver. There's no completely easily defined minimum signal that can go into a simple passive diode receiver that has no battery to it. You give me the right engineering raw materials, and I can make a more and more sensitive, with modern day techniques, a more and more sensitive a diode receiver. Is it receiving energy from the original transmitter? Absolutely. It's not violating any law of conservation of energy. If the original broadcast transmitter is transmitting, let me pick a number, 10,000 watts, and I'm sitting 15 miles away, and the signal getting to my little diode detector receiver happens to be minus 15 dBm, which is a real number, by the way. Minus 15 dBm is some number of microwatts, or is it picowatts? And if I've got a sensitive enough Schottky diode detector and a sensitive high enough impedance earphone, I will hear that signal. And a RFID, radio frequency identification tag, does do that. Let me drop. All of those millions of RFID tags that are out there that are on various items that you can buy in a clothing store, for instance, there is no battery on board. The RF energy from the transmitter 20 feet away gets picked up by that diode, gets rectified by the diode, it charges a capacitor, the capacitor becomes a temporary battery that runs the integrated circuit. The integrated circuit talks back to you 96 bits of data on that RFID back to your interrogator. Beautiful circuit, no batteries on board, and it can run for the next 100 years, if you know what I mean. And the amount of energy getting to those RFID tags, a modern-day, well-designed RFID tag, will respond correctly at minus 13 dBm of signal being picked up by its dipole. And it re-radiates that signal with pulses added to them, And as I said, no battery on board. Beautiful circuit. But it's not doing anything that's violating conservation of energy. You have supplied the energy from the handheld interrogator transmitter in your hand. It's got a, usually it's got a, if it's got a good design, it's got a three-element Yagi on the front end. And RIW is the guy who's got the antenna, he's got the patent on that particular antenna, if you know what I mean. And it sends a 6 dB gain signal, 1 watt of it, 20 feet out, gets picked up by the 900 megacycle dipole antenna on that RFID tag, and it talks back to you. And 96 bits of unique information comes back from that particular tag. A really beautiful circuit, but it's not violating any conservation of energy anywhere. Everything it does is predictable. Does that make some sense, Wes? We got to move on. N2XJN for a final on this one at this time. K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Does and it doesn't. We take the percentage wise. We have a 1 milliwatt of power from the transmitter. We have a number of detectors, not the modern, the germanium old style one, whatever it is, and we have placed them. And then you say it's infinite number of the receivers that could receive that. By that token, we have percentage-wise, don't talk about excitation of the plasma. Percentage-wise, infinite number of the fluorescent bulbs that could be the taking power from the source. Actually, it looks like they are. They not. But let me jump and finish the sentence. What I was trying to say, and maybe John later on would be able to trade it out. When you have a loop stick, that loop is made out of the copper wire and it's cut in one place, and you have two small plates that are welded to that loop. And then you have a charge on one of the plates. The current goes through that loop, goes to the other side of it. But then displacement current goes between them, and the vector of the displacement current is opposite to it. Now, what's happened? So, based on Maxwell equation, we have a cancellation of the field. And this, what I'm talking about is antenna and electromagnetic wave. So, if you straight out that loop and you have a 20 centimeters of the length of the wire with the plate on it. Now, you have a signal that creates the current or the charge that creates the current in that would be a dipole antenna, or at least a one piece of the wire that acts as an antenna. The charge goes to one of the plates, but the displacement current then goes between two plates, the upper one and the lower one. It will cancel it. So with the distance in ham radio operator, he has everything that he has in scientific calculations and derivation. What he actually proved is that it must be something that is not true. And that what you're saying is infinite number of the antennas receiving out of one source, 1 milliwatt source, that will be equal to percentage-wise infinite number of the light bulbs cut in the hand in the field, electric field or electrostatic field of the high voltage. Doesn't matter if we have an excitation. We have a percentage-wise. Enter his year.
Excellent. I'm going to say one last thing on this one. Thousands of radio amateurs have built 6-meter and 2-meter hula hoop antennas. It is a loop of wire with a capacitor at one end and various ways of impedance matching and feeding a signal into it. Works like a charm. Beautiful, nearly omnidirectional, nearly horizontal polarized antenna. 6 and 2 meters, lots of them are used on mobiles and on fixed stations, and they work like a charm. And so you can start analyzing it with displacement current, Maxwell's equations. There's a zillion ways you can look at it. The average amateur says, I'm going to buy a brand X hula hoop, or I'm going to, let me drop, or I'm going to go to the hardware store and buy the raw materials, the copper tubing to make the hula hoop antenna, and some aluminum plates or copper plates at the end, and a coax cable feeding it with some kind of usually a small current loop that feeds it at the far end away from the capacitor. But those hula hoop antennas work very well. There is no magic there. It is an inductor with a capacitor across it, therefore it's a resonator. But the inductor is not shielded. the injector is made as big as you can make it, displaced in space, and also, therefore the current flowing on that inductor creates a local magnetic field that gets radiated, and that antenna can have 98%, 99% efficiency. Lots and lots of hams have built them. They don't think there's anything magic there. And as a receiving antenna, you compare it to a dipole, its gain compared to a dipole is very similar, within a fraction of a dB of dipole-type gain. But the pattern is a little bit different. It's really omnidirectional, because you could say it's a dipole that's been curved around 360 degrees, and the two top-hat capacitors on the end of the dipole have been now merged into one resonating capacitor at the far end of the hula hoop antenna. As I said, lots of hams have built it. There is no magic there, from my point of view. Analyzing it, you can make a lot of magic out of it if you try to now relate it to displacement current and Maxwell's equations. You can try to make magic out of it, and you can think it's violating conservation of energy. I doubt that very highly. We've got to move on. I know that Bill, ACQIS, wanted to ask a question. Hope you're still with us, Bill. ACQIS, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2UPS, Dick has been trying to get in here for a long time. He's on Echolink.
Okay. We're going to pick up Bill and then Rich in that order. Bill, AC2IS. I hope you're still with us, Bill. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Bill got called away. K2UPS. Where are you located tonight, Rich? And what would you like to know? We'll discuss anything except antennas. I'm having some fun with you. K2, Uniform Papa Sierra, K2LIW. We'll wait until your signal comes through, Bill. Rich.
Okay, Dave, K2UPS Mobile. I'm currently in Pennsylvania, near New Stanton, heading back to New York. I had a comment earlier on the 2 meter full forwarder radios, but wasn't able to get in time. But you need to leave a lot more pauses or more frequent pauses so that people can get in on Echolink, because there's also a XC1GXG station on here on Echolink who has some questions about beverage antennas that I think you could probably help out with. I think it's a little late now for the comment on the 2 meter 440. But you might want to pick up Roberta out there also. XC1GXG.
Very fine, Rich. You can make your comment. Well, let's see if we can pick up Roberto, because that's unique. I don't think we've heard from Mexico ever on the TechNet. XE1, Golf X-Ray Golf, K2RIW on the TechNet. Standing by for you, Roberto.
I think K2UPS, I just see he posted that he has no microphone, so he's listening, but he can't hear. He did post a question on the chat room, though. And as one thing that you might want to consider is either if you or John monitors Echolink during the net, it would not be difficult to do. But if you just put this, you know, corner of your computer screen up, you could see people checking in. You could see them, you know, who's listening, where they are, and it just might help. You'll remember also to leave pauses there. And the only comment I had with the 2 meter 440 radio is I have the 208H. I have a couple of them. ICOM. And I like them a lot, and the reason that I do like it is that the microphone does not connect to the control head. It connects to the main body, and I like that better because I mount my control heads up on the roof of my vehicle, not on the dash, and I don't want the microphone cord dangling down. So there's different situations for different people. Dick, back to you.
NY2H.
Dick, I do have the question from Roberto. He's in Guadalajara, Mexico.
Very fine. We're going to take Roberto's question. Lou. Here we go. Lou, NY2H. Go right ahead with your comment, Lou.
Okay, well, John's got it covered. I saw the question is posted on our chat room, so John will take it from there. All right, NY2H out.
Glad you brought that to my attention. Go right ahead, John, with Roberto's question.
Very good. Yes, from the great state of Jalisco, my favorite one in Mexico. It's in Guadalajara, and his question is on a beverage antenna. He would like to
termination resistance is for and what does it do? Also, there's a question on how high should it be mounted, maybe minimal. I believe they're using it for 160.
Don, good question. Rhombic and beverage antenna. Rhombic, is that the right word? Let me think about that. Yeah, they call it a rhombic. Rhombic and beverage are the two antennas that are the exception to the usual rule. The vast majority of the antennas that we build and use are so-called standing wave structures. That really means the signal is going to bounce back and forth some number of times before it finally gets radiated. That forces us into making it the right electrical length so it's resonant, so that all of those bounces stay in step with each other, so that the current of each individual bounce adds with the current of all the other bounces, so to speak. That's the majority of antennas. But when it comes to beverage and rhombic, these are not standing wave antennas, they're a traveling wave antennas. That means when the rhombic or beverage is used correctly, the signal you put into it from your transmission line flows down the wire of that antenna once and only once, which is crazy, but that's what it does. In order to make, because radiation is so hard, because you get so little radiation out of each half wavelength of wire, let me drop. For that reason, your rhombic antenna and your beverage antenna are usually a significant number of wavelengths long. Each half wavelength is radiating something like 5% of the energy, and you're going to make it some number of wavelengths long. So continuous radiation is taking place from that wire along the whole length of the wire as that signal travels down the wire. In the case of a rhombic antenna and a beverage antenna, you usually put something like a 600 ohm resistor at the end. And the darn good question is, why do you put that resistor there? And what would happen if you remove that resistor? The nice thing about either of these traveling wave antennas is that as that signal travels down the wire, and the signal is being continuously radiated, but the signal traveling on the wire goes a little bit slower than free space. So the wire itself is a kind of a slow wave structure. It is a kind of a focusing structure. Even though your eye doesn't see it, that length of that wire and the way it radiates as a slow wave structure, it is acting a little bit like a magnifying glass, a great big magnifying glass in space. A well-constructed rhombic or beverage antenna will radiate a signal in one direction, and if you could see that signal as a three-dimensional diagram, it is a so-called pencil diagram, or it is it's a cucumber in space, but it's a fairly narrow cucumber. A well-designed beverage or rhombic antenna has one very narrow beam width with reasonably high gain in one direction. The signal flows down there once, it's continuously radiating off that wire, it's continuously leaking off that wire, but because the signal near the wire is flowing a little bit slower than the signal further away from the wire, it's a little bit like a Yagi. In the case of a Yagi antenna, a very long Yagi antenna, all of those directors are a kind of a slow wave structure. When you're receiving a signal on that Yagi, the signal that's near the boom is flowing a little bit more slowly than the signal further away from the boom. That creates a focusing effect. Let me drop. That magnifying glass that you use to focus the sun onto your piece of newspaper, it really is another kind of slow wave structure. The signal flowing through the center of the magnifying glass is going through a piece of glass. The glass has a certain velocity factor. The signal flowing through the glass is slower than free space, but the glass is thicker in the center. So the amount of sunlight flowing through the center of your magnifying glass is getting a little bit more delayed than the amount of sunlight flowing through the perimeter. That creates another focusing action. So whenever you've got a slow wave structure properly used, whether it be wire of a rhombic, wire of a beverage, or the slow wave structure of the long array of directors on a long Yagi, any of these slow wave structures are a beautiful magnifying glass as far as Mother Nature is concerned. Your eye doesn't see it that way until you know a little bit more about Huygens' principle and how this is really taking place and how a signal can be refracted by a slow wave structure. That magnifying glass is a refractor. Your long director. transistor string on a Yagi is a refractor. The long piece of wire on your beverage antenna is a refractor. Okay, what would happen if you didn't put the terminating resistor on that? Because in the real world, not all of the signal radiates. Remember, radiation is hard. Let me drop. So you're using your rhombic antenna as a transmitter for this example. And by the way, however it transmits, it receives equally as well. A rhombic, like every other antenna, obeys the law of reciprocity. Whatever pattern and gain and performance you get on transmit, essentially you get the exact same performance on reception. So it's a little easier to analyze it as a transmitter. I'm transmitting a signal into my beverage antenna. I've launched the signal into one end. The signal is traveling down that wire, being radiated into space, and it's giving me a beautiful pencil beam in the direction of the wire. Not all of that signal gets radiated. If I remove the terminating resistor at the far end, the little bit of signal that's left over, maybe it's 10 or 20%, but some amount of signal is left over, which would have been absorbed by that terminating resistor at the far end. You've decided to eliminate that terminating resistor. You've got a remotely controlled relay, you've given the command, and now the resistor is an open circuit, if you know what I mean. Of the signal that hits the open end, the far end of the rhombic, where the terminating resistor is, if the terminating resistor ain't there, that signal reflects and goes back in the other direction. You carefully measure the pattern of a rhombic antenna or a beverage antenna without the terminating resistor, and you have just lost some of your front-to-back ratio. The signal that bounces off the far end now travels down the wire in the reverse direction, and it gets radiated, and it creates a back lobe. So you don't, it doesn't catch on fire. Bad things don't happen. You don't have a huge change in the impedance that your transmission line feeds when you remove that resistor. But your front-to-back ratio, a real good beverage, a real good rhombic. Let me drop. A real good beverage, a real good rhombic, could easily have a front-to-back ratio of maybe 20 decibels, which is pretty darn good. That means only 1% of the signal is radiated in the back compared to the front. You remove the terminating resistor, and maybe your front-to-back ratio is going to become 9 dB instead of 20 dB. I don't know the exact number, but it's in that ballpark. So if you want to use your rhombic or beverage antenna during a DX contest, and you want to find out who's in the back lobe of your antenna, you command your relay at the far end to go away, and now you receive that back lobe. In my example, where it went from 20 dB down to 9 dB down, any of those guys in the back lobe just got 11 dB stronger because you've commanded the resistor to go away. Or if you go one step further, you've got a great big long transmission line laying on the ground and a set of relays, so that now you feed the other end of the beverage antenna, and now you fire in the other direction with a terminating resistor nearby, if you want to have a good front-to-back ratio in the reverse. Nice thing about the rhombic or the beverage antennas, without too much difficulty, you can make it feed forward or make it feed backwards by which end you feed, and you can adjust the front-to-back ratio by the terminating resistor. Let me drop. The nice thing about a beverage antenna is it doesn't necessarily have to be high off the ground. I believe you get more performance if it's high off the ground, but a beverage antenna, there are people who have mounted a beverage antenna something like a tenth of a wavelength off the ground and got darn good performance. Maybe a 20, tenth of a wavelength in that order, maybe an eighth of a wavelength. It can be mounted very close to the ground in wavelength and give good performance, because even though you're losing some signal into absorption of the earth, and maybe half your signal is being absorbed that way because it's so close to the ground, still, the antenna, that would be 3 dB down from ideal, but the antenna, well-built beverage or rhombic antenna, could have 20 decibels of gain, and because you've mounted it close to the ground, and you've got some ground reception, a ground absorption, 3 dB less than 20 dB of gain is 17 dB, and that's still a damn good antenna, particularly at the low frequencies, if you know what I mean. So, it's not a popular antenna. Let me drop. It's not a popular antenna because a lot of people don't understand it. At first they say it's too simple. They don't know what's going on. Why should it work? I don't have enough property to build it. I got a lot of trees on my property, and are the trees going to stop the rhombic or the beverage from working? Absolutely not. At HF frequency, trees are almost purely transparent, and they could be nice support structures too. And does the beverage or the rhombic have to be exactly the same number of wavelengths off the ground for the whole length? Absolutely not. It's very forgiving. So guys don't understand it. The next thing a guy who's new to ham radio worries about is that why in the world did you build an antenna with a terminating resistor into it? In other words, from their point of view, it's throwing away some of the power. I don't want to build an antenna that's got a lossy device inside. When there was a famous broadband dipole antenna with a mysterious black box in the center that was sealed with some kind of very difficult to take apart epoxy, and this broadband antenna was very well advertised. Lots of people used it. We're very happy. All of a sudden, somebody at the ARRL headquarters took apart that black box, and they found that there was a terminating resistor in the center of that dipole that was part of how it had broadband went through it. Up until then, everybody was happy with the antenna. They suddenly found out there was a lossy element inside, and all of a sudden the antenna, it was dirty, if you know what I mean. Otherwise, people didn't want to go near that antenna, and they said all kinds of derogatory remarks about that company that built a broadband antenna. By putting a terminating resistor in the antenna so it's more broadband, so that when you QSY, let me drop. When you QSY, you don't have to retune your antenna tuner as fast. In the heat of battle of a contest, that's a very handy antenna. The fact that it's wasting half of the power, you're putting 100 watts into it, and only 50 watts is being radiated because of that terminating resistor. That's an extremely good compromise. You have an S unit down as to the potential signal you could be, but now the antenna is so broadband that as you QSY across the portion of the band you're using, you don't have to keep retuning the antenna tuner if it's a manual antenna tuner, or you don't have to wait for the automatic antenna tuner to work. So in that environment, it's a darn good antenna. And the fact that it's got a lossy terminating resistor in there that was kept a secret, and the fact that people said all these derogatory remarks about it, they really misunderstood the physics involved. So Beveridge is a darn nice antenna. Doesn't have to be mounted super high. Does have to be quite a number of wavelengths long to get the performance you usually need. And the terminating resistor at the end is no real mystery. It just creates the front-to-back ratio. Whoever's listening to me right now probably has some more questions about this. Why does it work so well? Why is it so simple? What should I do in this particular circumstance? You're allowed to ask those questions right now. I'm going to pass it over to you, John, because I think you're watching the conference board, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, has anyone else got any further questions on Beveridge, K2RIW and the TechNet? Have a good. We better live a nice long pause in case someone wants to chime in from the outer areas.
This is AC2IS with an unrelated question.
Yeah, let me make sure we go to this one, because I did call you before, Bill, and we're going to get back to you. John, is there anyone else on the chat room that has any further questions on Beveridge? And from your point of view, John, do you think I've given a mental image as to how the Beveridge works? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have an additional question from Guadalajara. Rob would like to know the definition and what is a traveling wave antenna. You spoke that you mentioned that. They don't seem to know what that references. So you described the Beveridge perfectly. Try the traveling wave if you can give a description of what that means and how it works. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. 90-some-odd% of all the antennas in the world are standing wave structures. A dipole is a standing wave structure. Standing wave means it really internally operates with a high standing wave ratio. A transmission line that you don't put the right termination at the far end, where some signal gets reflected, you end up with a pretty high standing wave ratio. That really means signal is bouncing back and forth. So most antennas, like a dipole, the signal bounces back and forth, we call it a standing wave structure. In the case of a Beveridge antenna or a rhombic antenna, we call it a traveling wave structure. The signal travels down the wire once. The signal thinks there is no standing wave ratio on that radiating wire because the signal travels down there once. It hits the 600 ohm approximately terminating resistor at the far end. Any signal that's left over that didn't get radiated gets absorbed. So the wire, the radiating wire of a Beveridge antenna really is a kind of transmission line which has the right terminating resistor at the far end. The signal goes down there once, the standing wave ratio on the wire of a beverage antenna is a very low number. We call it a traveling wave structure because the signal travels down there once, does not reflect. Because it doesn't reflect, there is no standing wave. Therefore, it has no standing wave ratio, so to speak, unless you remove the terminating resistor because you want to look at that back lobe, so to speak. So traveling wave means the signal goes down there once. Standing wave means internal to the antenna, there's going to be a high standing wave ratio. The signal bounces back and forth. We call, let me drop, questions. We've been calling a dipole a standing wave structure all of these years. Hidden in those words is the fact that the signal is bouncing back 20 times. Why the hell the people writing the books didn't say what the standing wave means? The signal is bouncing back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. That's the most basic information you need. Therefore, you know you're going to resonate that antenna if you want it to radiate well, because you want all of those bounces that have to be there. If it's a small antenna, half wavelength long is a small antenna compared to a beverage, which is usually, let me pick a number, 6 wavelengths long or even more if you've got the real estate to do it. So I think you said you've got a question there, Wes. Go ahead.
In terms of standing wave, at the end you have a proper terminating resistor, as we could say. Then as the signal is being absorbed, what is that signal being changed to? Would that be heat? Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, Wes. Any dummy load that's worth its weight in salt, any terminating resistor, any resistor in general, will dissipate energy. It will take energy, convert it from one form to another. Your dummy load antenna, your terminating resistor at the far end of a rhombic or a beverage antenna, converts that electromagnetic wave. It's got some current and some voltage, and it takes the energy, volts times current is watts. It takes the watts, and watts per time is joules. It takes the joules of energy, converts it into heat. That's the one form of energy conversion that in many cases is not reversible. You take your 100-watt transmitter at 3.5 megacycles, you put it into your 50-ohm shielded dummy load, your 100 watts gets turned into 100 watts of heat. And now, that's the one process that appears to be non-reversible. You heat up that terminating resistor with 100 watts of heater, and you'd like to think you're going to get the 3.5 megacycle signal back. Absolutely not. That one's non-reversible. So, by the laws of thermodynamics, when you take your energy and convert it from one form to another, electromagnetic energy into heat, usually it's lost as far as normal operation is concerned. Now, a smart person could put a bunch of thermocouples and other kinds of energy conversion devices on that dummy load and capture that thermal energy and do something with it. But we usually don't go there. So what was the additional question Roberto had there, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I don't have any additional information on why he's asking this particular question, but he wanted to know, in radio astronomy, is a beverage antenna of any use? Maybe you could make a few comments on that.
I'm pretty sure the answer is absolutely yes. A beverage antenna and a rhombic antenna usually are used for HF frequencies. Because to try to develop a whole lot of gain at, say, for instance, 160 meters, 1.8 megacycles, if you wanted to build a six-element Yagi on 160 meters, boy, you better have a lot of real estate, a lot of radio towers, a lot of very strong pieces of tubing, something like 250 feet long pieces of tubing with all kinds of support structures. It's difficult. However, with enough trees on your property and enough property to string six wavelengths of wire in one direction at approximately the same altitude, and that's not mandatory, as a beverage antenna with a bunch of slingshots launching the wire into the trees and stringing it all in one direction, if you're If you wanted a lot of gain, aim to the